Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
After a slew of wildfires, the governor is declaring a state of emergency. In the past week alone, fires have blazed from Florida's Gulf Coast to Orlando to Alligator Alley.
Well, we are currently working over 107 fires statewide. There is no corner of the state that is not facing severe wildfire conditions.
The Florida Senate's reservoir plan has gone through yet another iteration, but it's unclear if the newest changes will garner support in the House.
We'll see, but I think that the more the Senate works on it, the happier we are.
Also tonight, immigration issues continue to dominate the political conversation. We take a look at the issues confronting Florida lawmakers and Haitians living in Miami. I'm Lynn Hatter in for Tom Flanagan. It's day two of the sixth week in the 2017 Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. Governor Rick Scott is declaring a state of emergency as more than 100 wildfires flare across the state. With drought conditions spreading and more hot weather ahead, there's little indication the blazes will slow down. Kate Payne reports.
Governor Rick Scott's emergency declaration comes just days after a brush fire swept across St. George Island. Mason Bean is a volunteer firefighter in the small resort community.
We had a neighbor that was just burning trash in his backyard that got away about 2:30 in the afternoon. We got the call. We thought it was just going to be a simple brush fire and an easy knockdown, but wind kicked up, a lot of fuel, and the next thing you know, we can't seem to run it down.
The fire is still smoldering on the island. Just last week, another fire broke out along International Drive in Orlando. Local resident Allison Jones filmed the smoke drifting toward Disney and Universal Studios.
This is nuts. On our way home from Legoland, there's this huge brush fire that's near Disney. And here comes a helicopter bringing water in for the brush fire.
And a series of fires have plagued Collier County, burning along Alligator Alley, a major highway running from Naples to Fort Lauderdale. These are just some of the most recent flare-ups.
Well, we are currently working over 107 fires statewide. There is no corner of the state that is not facing severe wildfire conditions, totaling nearly 24,000 acres.
Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam says this year's weather conditions make for a perfect storm.
So the record rainfall that we had last year causes everything to bloom and to grow and to really take off. And then when it stops raining, now you have the woods full of kindling.
Now add humans to that mix.
Think about what you're doing, whether it's equipment use or whether it's where you park your vehicle in the grass anymore. Throwing cigarettes out, absolutely, in these dry conditions. Campfires, all of it is be careful.
Jim Carls heads the Florida Forest Service. He says most forest fires are caused by people, which is why Putnam wants residents to be cautious and obey burn bans.
Don't be that person that thinks the rules don't apply to you and you end up costing your neighbors their property, their home, and putting our firefighters' lives at risk and your fellow Floridians' lives at risk.
Jim Carls wants to get the human-caused fires under control now, before summer lightning storms bring more flare-ups.
We know the lightning's coming. Florida's the lightning capital of the world. come April, come May, June, and July, lightning is going to hit this state hard, as it always does every year. And the drought really intensifies that, because then you start to see a lot of these fires from the lightning.
In the meantime, the governor's emergency declaration will make it easier for the state to share resources and fight the fires. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Senate President Joe Negron's priority water project is now heading for a floor vote. Nick Evans tells us after shifting and twisting through committees, the measure's fate is uncertain.
The Senate plan to build a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee is set for the Senate floor Wednesday. Southern water storage is seen by many environmentalists as the most effective way to reduce toxic discharges from the lake and feed fresh water to the Everglades. Last year in a Stewart auditorium, supporters got a powerful champion in Senate President Joe Negron.
This is not going to be easy. This is going to be a long and difficult journey to accomplish this. I'm 100% committed to doing it, and I believe we can do it.
And Negron's forecast for the road ahead was spot on. The Stewart Republicans' top priority for this year's session has faced criticism on multiple fronts. The governor didn't include the reservoir in his spending plan. The House is skeptical of buying new land and adamantly opposes borrowing to fund the project. Free market think tank the James Madison Institute argues a reservoir north of the lake would be more effective. And some in the Everglades Agricultural Area, or EAA, say water storage could cripple their local economies. Here's former Hendry County Commissioner Janet Taylor.
So when you are considering all these things, we want you to remember there are people, not fish, not grass, and not another thing, but there are people that live in these communities that you are talking about.
Negron put the measure in the hands of Fleming Island Republican Rob Bradley, and his response was swift. At the second committee hearing, Bradley tacked on amendments paying for septic to sewer conversions and sending conservation dollars to the Keys and the St. Johns River in a bid to build support within the chamber.
The feedback I received was, while we understand and appreciate that what happened in the Caloosahatchee and St. Lucie estuaries is unacceptable, it was a state of emergency, that we need to make sure that we address all areas of the state.
But House Budget Chief Carlos Trujillo stood firm in opposition to buying new land.
We have more than enough land that we can manage. I think if you look at our budget, we have to make informed decisions and we have to make tough decisions.
So Bradley went back to the drawing board and came back with a raft of changes for the bill's final committee. Those conservation dollars for the Keys and St. John's, gone. Borrowing, delayed for a year. And buying new land? Well, perhaps the state won't.
It revises the EAA reservoir project to utilize the A2 parcel, which is already owned by the South Florida Water Management District, and use that to provide a minimum of 240,000 acre-feet of storage through a deep storage reservoir and water quality treatment features.
To translate, that means the footprint shrinks and the reservoir gets deeper to compensate. And House opposition has softened somewhat, but there are likely more changes in store if Negron's plan eventually gains passage. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Still to come on Capitol Report, we'll hear the latest on a bill intending to build on past efforts to combat human trafficking.
We have a lot of heinous crimes in our society. This one, I believe, is one of the most egregious. And I think it's very important that we need to bring it more to light, and I believe this bill does that.
Lawmakers say it's time to lift a cap, giving cottage food operators a little more freedom.
The cap's arbitrary, and it puts us in the bottom five states in the country in terms of, economic food liberty.
And in Jacksonville, a protest turned violent goes viral.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Immigration legislation appears to be moving faster in the Florida House than it is in the Senate. Governor Rick Scott and that chamber have different priorities this session, possibly putting immigration proposals on the back burner. Sarah Mueller has that story.
Another Florida county is now on a list of governments the feds accuse of refusing to cooperate with immigration officials. The Department of Homeland Security says the Marion County Sheriff's Office declined to hold two suspected illegal immigrants after they were due to be released from custody in February. Republican Representative Larry Metz wants to stop Florida counties from declining immigration and customs enforcement requests. Metz has a bill that would eliminate all sanctuary policies and require state and local governments to comply with detainer requests.
The Republican caucus has been largely supportive of it. The Democrats have been largely opposed to it. So it has been pretty much a party line vote in the two committees that we've been through this year.
Metz introduced legislation banning sanctuary jurisdictions in the state last year, but it didn't move in the Senate. And Metz says he's not sure it will pass this year either.
The apparent lack of interest in my bill both last year and this year signals to me somehow, I don't know exactly how I can trace it back, but someone in the Senate in a position of authority, whether it's a committee chair or somebody else, seems to be against the idea of banning sanctuary jurisdictions in Florida.
Metz's proposal is now in the House Judiciary Committee, its last stop before hitting the House floor. Companion legislation by Republican Senator Aaron Bean is in that chamber's Judiciary Committee. But that's its first committee, and no vote has been taken.
The appetite for that committee is not for immigration reform or sanctuary city reform, which is unfortunate, but that's just the cards that we were dealt.
Critics of the proposals label them as mean and xenophobic. Another immigration-related bill moving in the House comes from Republican Representative Dane Eagle. His measure makes sentences tougher for undocumented people who commit crimes like sexual assault or murder. If it passes, Florida would be the first state to have such a rule. But Eagle says he has no concerns it would pass constitutional muster.
When it comes to some violent felons, we need to lock them up and throw away the key. And what we're talking about here are violent felons, where our taxpayer dollars should be going to incarcerate them.
Senate Minority Leader Oscar Brainin said in January it's unfair to punish someone because they're an immigrant. He says Eagle took a lot of stuff out of the legislation to make it more palatable.
More comfortable than the previous bill, yes. Am I still voting no? Yes.
Senator Travis Hudson's companion bill on increasing penalties based on immigration status is also in its last committee, but it's been stuck there for more than a month. Metz does have one piece of legislation related to immigration on the House floor. It's a symbolic request to Congress asking the federal government to let states require proof of citizenship when registering to vote. All voters certify under oath they are citizens, but Metz says he doesn't think that's enough.
But it should be acted on. It's a very clearly worded memorial that addresses three areas of statutory interpretation that have constrained the state's ability to ensure the integrity of their voter rolls with respect to non-citizens voting in elections.
Senator Bean says he would likely vote in favor of the House immigration proposals, but he's not holding out a lot of hope they'll make it through the Senate. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Now to Miami. Temporary protected status for tens of thousands of Haitians here is expiring soon. Will President Donald Trump extend it for them or send them back to the hemisphere's most crisis-plagued country? WLRN's Tim Padgett has this report.
I used to host Haiti Journal on WPPT.
Farah Larieux is a Haitian who's lived in South Florida for 12 years. She's hosted a local public television talk show on Haitian affairs. She has a TV production company.
I still have my entertainment show on Tele Anacauna that airs in South Florida.
Achievement awards and community service plaques hang on the walls of her house in Miramar. But anxiety also hangs over Larieux's life here and will for another 3 months.
If President Trump doesn't sign the executive order to extend TPS for Haitians, your life collapses and you're going to be on deportation proceeding too.
TPS means temporary protected status. It's the federal program that lets Larieux and almost 60,000 other Haitians stay in the U.S. since an earthquake destroyed much of Haiti in 2010. Since then, Haitian TPS has been renewed every 18 months. That's mainly because disasters, natural and political, keep making Haiti a dangerous place to go back to. TPS expires again on July 22nd. This time, the U.S. president who decides whether to renew it is Donald Trump.
You try to not think about it because it's too stressful.
Stressful, of course, because of President Trump's high-profile crackdown on immigration. Many Haitians who have TPS report they've lost jobs here because their employers feel certain Trump won't renew their work permits. Marlene Bastien heads Femmes Haïtiennes, or Haitian Women of Miami. Last week, Femmes and other groups held a press conference in Miami's Little Haiti neighborhood to lobby Trump for TPS extension. They laid out why they believe letting TPS expire would be cruel to Haitians here and counterproductive to U.S.-Haiti policy. One big reason? Last month, workers for the charity Food for the Poor discovered 240 Haitians living in a cave in southwest Haiti. Among them were these children singing hymns. They'd been left homeless and foodless by the devastation of Hurricane Matthew last fall. Food for the Poor staff member Debbie Springer was one of the first to see them.
It was so silent. Like, you could hear the water droplets and you could hear the breathing, and it was so labored and everyone was coughing.
And they were just the latest victims found living in caves in Haiti. Angela Loma is Food for the Poor's director, based in Coconut Creek. He says it's one more jolting sign that Haiti, the Western Hemisphere's poorest country, still isn't fit to take back so many expats.
They would put a tremendous burden on the country. Where crisis is the norm, the mortality rate is 1 out of every 14 children. No developed nation would accept that. They should allow them to stay here, make a living here. When they send remittances, we see homes in Haiti going up.
In fact, the more than $1 billion in remittances Haitians in the U.S. send back to Haiti each year represents a large part of that country's GDP. Advocates also argue that since most Haitians who have TPS are so embedded here, deporting them would be a big blow to their communities. The federal government has said TPS holders may not adjust their immigration status to something more permanent. But this month, a federal appeals court in San Francisco ruled that since they're lawfully here, they can. As for Trump himself, he has not indicated if he'll extend TPS for Haitians this summer, or if he'll decide temporary protected status has become too permanent and end it. Haitians here remember what Trump told them during his campaign last year.
I really want to be your greatest champion, and I will be your champion, whether you vote for me or not.
Donald Trump came to Little Haiti, where we are right now, and he said that he will be the best president for Haitians.
That's former Haitian Prime Minister Laurent Lamothe visiting Haiti last week to promote his foundation to aid rural Haiti. He says Haitians take Trump at his word, but if there's one thing he knows about Trump, it's that you never know. I'm Tim Padgett.
A bill building on Florida's anti-human trafficking efforts is now heading to both the House and Senate floors. Sasha Cordner reports.
Miami Republican Representative Jeanette Nunez also sits on the statewide council for human trafficking led by Attorney General Pam Bondi. And this year, Nunez is sponsoring a bill meant to help young trafficking victims.
This bill arose in response to a recent OPAGA report recommending several changes to the way the state tracks the well-being of human trafficking victims who are legal residents here in the state of Florida. The bill revises and makes certain changes to definitions. For instance, the bill now references the term commercial sexual exploitation to mean the use of any person under 18 for sexual purposes in exchange or promise of money, goods, or services. This definition replaces the term sexually exploited child, which was not capturing the nature of commercial exploitation.
Nunez says the bill also changes the role of the Florida Department of Children and Families in dealing with these victims.
First, the department must submit to the legislature a report using information from the CBC lead agencies, noting the prevalence of commercial sexual exploitation, specialized services provided to treat the children, and local service capacity. Secondly, the bill also requires the department to maintain data on children who are verified victims of commercial sexual exploitation referred to non-safe house services in the community. Current law only requires them to maintain data on children referred to safe houses.
Stewart Republican Representative Gail Harrell, one of the bill's sponsors, says this helps build on past legislative efforts.
This legislature has been committed for many years to stopping this most heinous of crimes. And we started it back in 2012, made some major changes in statute then, and have moved forward since. This is modern-day slavery, and we have to make sure that especially our children are protected.
And Beverly Hills Republican Representative Ralph Masullo agrees.
We have a lot of heinous crimes in our society. This one, I believe, is one of the most egregious because it not only murders someone mentally, but it tortures them.
And I think it's very important that we need to bring it more to light, and I believe this bill does that. And I'd like to think that hopefully this is something that we could actually cure in our society.
Both the House and Senate versions also went through a recent change. Clearwater Republican Senator Jack Latvella says it requires nurses take a 2-hour human trafficking course in order to maintain their license.
It does not add more hours. It just adds a section within the existing hours. And we're finding that training health professionals is a great way to identify people that are being trafficked. And so this would just add to the core of people looking for those kind of problems.
And Hialeah Republican Rene Garcia, the bill Senate sponsor, says he likes that change to the bill.
This goes a long way to make sure, because that's the biggest problem that we have, is making sure that we have our healthcare professionals to identify individuals that have been human trafficked, and this will go a long way to start helping that problem.
After passing their final committees last week, both the House and Senate bills will now be considered by their respective chambers. The House version is scheduled to be taken up Thursday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
A measure that would allow small-scale bakers and beekeepers to expand their businesses is moving through the legislature. Riga McCarthy has more.
Farmers markets like this one at Tallahassee's Lake Ella are full of fresh fruits and vegetables. They're also a great place to find people working in the cottage food industry. It's something Brandon Republican Senator Tom Lee says he didn't know much about until just this year.
These are foods with a very low health safety risk that can be stored at room temperature, including breads, cookies, honey, and all those other fattening things.
Cottage food operators work out of their homes under a bill passed in 2011. Before that, in order to sell a food item, small-scale operators were forced to rent out an industrial kitchen, which could lead to some big bills. Lee says before the legislative session started this year, members of the industry approached him to sponsor a bill giving them a little more wiggle room.
Under current law, the food operator at home is limited to $15,000 a year in sales. This bill increases the annual gross sales limitation for cottage food operators who are operating from their home from $15,000 to $50,000.
The measure also allows food operators to take payments over the internet, although Lee says the food could not be shipped and would need to be delivered in person. Ari Bargel is with the Institute for Justice and advocates for national food freedom. He says while he supports the bill, he'd like to see it go even further. Bargel argues there's no reason for a cap on the industry.
This is an industry that is itself self-limited in terms of its income-producing potential. There's only so much money that you can make selling essentially baked goods out of your own kitchen.
Representative Frank White, a Pensacola Republican, is sponsoring similar legislation in the House. He agrees, saying the current cap on cottage industry sales doesn't make sense.
The cap's arbitrary, and it puts us in the bottom five states in the country in terms of, call it, economic food liberty.
White says increasing the amount of income a person is allowed to make through their cottage food business to $50,000 will put Florida in line with policies in Texas and California. And White says allowing cottage food operators to make sales online opens up a new marketing platform for them.
So many cottage food operators market their products through Facebook. And there's this sort of artificial barrier where you can't pay through the Facebook app. You've got to go exchange money in person or swipe a card.
Some lawmakers have raised concerns the changes could increase the risk to the public caused by bad actors, but White says he's confident that won't be a problem. He says the food cottage industry participants make is limited to foods that don't tend to pose a public health risk. And he says there's a personal aspect to the business.
There's this principle that if you know you're selling something to somebody face-to-face and it's kind of eyeball to eyeball, you got to be a pretty nasty person to want to poison them. So because it's direct connection, almost producer to consumer, there's a degree of safety from as a policymaker that I felt comfortable with.
The measure has passed through the full House. It's scheduled for its final committee hearing in the Senate Wednesday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Finally tonight, progressive activists are calling the arrest of five protesters Friday in Hemming Park unjust. As WJCT's Lindsay Kilbride reports, Jacksonville attorney John Phillips says he's conducting a review of what happened during the protest as he prepares to represent at least one of those arrested.
The arrests happened Friday evening during a demonstration against last week's U.S. airstrikes in Syria. Phillips says he's reviewing all available evidence of what led to the arrests.
We start today, and we're going to investigate. We don't do just an over-the-weekend investigation and say, you know, this crime was violated or not. We're going to investigate all the parties.
As widely circulated videos show, chaos broke out between protesters, one counter-protester, and police. Five protesters were arrested on felony charges, including inciting a riot, resisting arrest, and battery on an officer. One video shows the start of the scuffle when a counter-protester, who goes by the name Gary Snow, gives a middle finger to protester Connell Crooms. When Crooms seems to lunge towards Snow, police take Crooms down. Snow says protesters were taking his belongings. He called into WJCT's First Coast Connect Monday.
So they were the first ones to engage. And I reacted and retrieved my property. And after that incident, things got heated and escalated. And that's when JSO had stepped in.
Snow was not arrested, and police say Crooms was the violent aggressor. A video shows several officers trying to arrest him, but some observers are outraged, including his mother, saying it was brutality because he's deaf and couldn't hear their commands. Wells Todd with the Progressive Coalition says he's considering a lawsuit against JSO.
But we're holding Sheriff Williams and the police department here responsible for what happened. And we're asking for a public apology, and we're asking the city to pay for damages.
Other videos show Snow prior to the incident that evening with a large pro-Donald Trump flag, yelling over protesters and jumping on stage with them. Protesters asked police to separate him from them, but they didn't. Snow regularly counter-protests events seen as anti-Trump or anti-police. There's also a video online of his burning and shooting a Pan-African flag with a gun. He says he did it in response to groups burning the American flag.
Because I actually stand up to racism. Racism comes in any form and any color. We have a new movement in America called Black Supremacy and Black Nationalists.
He denies he was trying to incite a riot Friday, as protesters say. Jacksonville Sheriff Mike Williams said in an email statement, officers don't tell groups where to stand during protests. He says protesters are encouraged to respond to agitators in a calm demeanor and must refrain from physical violence. However, he says the incident has prompted him to look into how JSO manages protests, and new protocols may need to be put into place. I'm Lindsay Kilbride in Jacksonville.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Lynn Hatter. Tom Flanagan will be back later this week. Join us each day for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.